This is the first substance section of the PDH online course EE Overview on School Design. Pre-design, controlling regulations. This topic refers to two distinct types of regulations, funding and legal. Funding refers to requirements of the agency providing the capital funds for design and construction. For schools, these requirements are actually legal, but they are enforced by withholding of funds. From whom does the electrical engineer get a copy of the funding restrictions? It's very appropriate to draft a detailed letter to the architect early in the project, requesting copies or a meeting. Often, no written form exists, and sometimes the architect is hesitant to go on record. The form of the list or agenda for the meeting should be much more circumspect, but should contain the following items. Do I include in my drawings new fire alarm system? An upgrade to the existing fire alarm system to meet current requirements. Voice notification of alarms on the fire alarm. Will there be a fire pump and booster pump? Classroom data jacks, how many and in what form? Wiring from the classroom data jacks to the data closet. Racks of patch bays and data switches in the data closet. UPS for the data closet racks. Home run fiber optic from the data closets to the main data center. Racks of patch bays and data switches in the main data center. Server racks in the main data center. Software from servers and clients. High-speed data utility termination racks. High-speed data services from the utility. Receptacle boxes and steel conduit from data jacks to above ceiling space. Steel conduit from wall conduit to hallway. Ladder cable tray to pick up classroom cables and take them to the data closet and data center. Data jacks and cables, patch bays and switches for voice over IP telephones. Instruments, that is telephones, on the desk, on the wall, or on the wall at the door. The telephone switch in the main data center. UPS for the telephone switch. Preferred classroom lighting levels per calculations, perhaps 30-foot candles or 50-foot candles. Dual level switching. Motion detectors. Preferred lighting levels for offices, gym, library, student eating area. Will dual level switching and motion detectors be used? Now, this is a big list and it came at you real fast, but the core of this course will be to review each of these topics so that very brief summary will make more sense. The legal regulation should be identified by the architect in response to the following questions. Should I base my design on the 2005 NFPA 70 National Electric Code? Are there any local special requirements? Should I base it upon 2002 NFPA 72 Fire Alarm Code? The ASHRAE 90-05 Energy Code? 2004 NFPA 780 for lightning protection. Now, I will stray from the outline at this point. When we say the 2005 NFPA 70 National Electric Code, awful lot of people think that's the only code there is. And that's not the case. Individual municipalities and sometimes states can be very slow adopting the current code. So it's possible to be building a school under the 2002 National Electric Code or even the 1999 National Electric Code. And it's something you must resolve at the beginning of the project. You don't want to wait till the end of the project to find out that a redesign is required because some inspector comes by and starts red-tagging equipment. Pre-design, construction, and design estimating. A priority of many stakeholders in school construction is budget control. At the time the electrical engineer joins the project, the budget is only a little flexible between accounts primarily, but rigid in total amount. Exceptions relate to special funding for alternate designs based upon uncertain but hoped for sources. Maybe that came by a little fast also. There is an amount associated with a construction project. Even if the bond levy hasn't been passed yet, somebody has in their mind, whether they're talking a $2 million school or a $5 million school or a $20 million school. And very early on, the electrical engineer is going to be asked to do a construction cost estimate to see if what he's thinking is matching what they're thinking. This exceptions relating to special funding. There's all kinds of strange school money out there. The schools are very sensitive to this. Some architects are sensitive to it. Some of them are unaware of it. But things like, I'm trying to think, there's a wonderful example where you can buy the computers with your capital money, but you can't buy software, but they're separate funds for software that are only released twice a year, and it's not on the same schedule as your construction schedule, so you don't know if you're going to get the software money or not. But these things have an impact on the design, and they're better explored early on to find out what the choices are and what the design basis to begin the project. The first step, and a frequent intermediate step, is the construction estimate. There are three components of a construction estimate: items, cost per items, and computation. Now, this is so basic, there's nothing to argue about, except that you'll see a lot of strange estimates out there based upon things that can be explained, but are certainly not obvious. For this course, we're talking about items, cost per item, and computation. That's not just the extension of the number of items times the cost per item, but it's good to write down where each of the numbers came from, so when people ask you about it, you can answer the questions intelligently. When the factors in the project change, you can change your estimate. Recently, we just had a tremendous spike in raw crude oil prices, which immediately affected PVC conduit. Well, if PVC conduits are called out in the estimate, it's easy to jack that up to a current market situation. Items mean preliminary design. It is not possible to do any kind of rational construction estimate without having a scope of work. How many rooms, how big the rooms, whether you're having a central chiller plant or rooftop units. Now, at the beginning of the project, you're wrong in a lot of these assumptions, but if you spend some time thinking about it, the aggregate will still be correct. It's just the location will be wrong. And that's why I'm emphasizing you should look at this as a preliminary design, even if you do a cost per square foot estimate. Many managers will demand that only bulk dollars per square foot figures be used early in the project. This can be disastrous if special conditions are known and not included in the costing. And I'm always hearing about problems with soil conditions. Maybe that's because I sit near the civil engineers. There are problems in electrical conditions. What if the utility doesn't have enough power in this part of the county to supply a new major building? Well, typically they will build it for free, but they've got a two-year schedule for building stuff. If it doesn't come to light that the power, the bulk power, isn't available, it may not be there in time to open the school on schedule. So again, bulk dollars per square foot has value. It has a place, and it's certainly a first answer. But a preliminary design has to follow along as quickly as possible, and be on the lookout for special conditions that are going to cost money. An optional narrative comes in here. Where do items in the cost estimate come from? Where do the cost per item come from? In 35 years, your instructor has done back of the envelope one line diagram and consulted Means Electrical Estimating Guide. For 2005, it cost $112, available from www.rsmeans.com. That's not an advertisement for them. That's just a factual source of something that works well. There are competitive estimating guides available. For years, a pencil and paper estimate was expected, was economically prepared, and met all needs. A recommended form is an 11 by 17 sheet with large columns and wide ruling. Then it can be copied down to 8.5 by 11 for easy filing and fax transmittal. And it looks really slick, even if you got a little bit crummy writing or lettering. I really like this idea of using a big form and shrinking it down. There is a sample in the written version of this course. And again, it's just a column for each of the things you need. I like to head each page with project, the estimates done by, with a person's initials, a date, page blank of blank. The column headings are ref, item, count, description, dollars material per unit, dollars material extension, hours per unit, hours extension, line total, and group total. Notice we are not putting dollars in for labor because most people insist upon putting the dollars per hour at the end of the estimate, multiplying out the project hours by the dollars per hour to see what the labor cost is. The reason they put it at the end is different people have different opinions. They can put in different numbers and see how it affects the total cost. And it's very dependent upon whether it's union or non-union, whether the contractors are hungry at the time it goes out for bid, or if they got too much work to take it comfortably. Place at the bottom for notes. And page totals for the dollars material extension and hour extension. Let's see what it says here. Where, ref, it's the page number in means that you used. Now again, the reason I use means is I'm comfortable with it. It seems to be very exhaustive. It has defects, which we'll talk about in a moment. It doesn't solve all problems, but it gives you a good structure and it gives you a starting point. Item is a sequential identifier, so you can talk to people on the phone. They're talking about item 25, you're talking about item 25, there's no confusion. Count, the number required in the area under study, for instance, 4 for duplex receptacles in a storeroom. Description, a precise description, multiple line as needed, such as receptacle, including device and faceplate, 25 foot of 2 number 12 ground, 3/4 inch conduit, termination on both ends. Dollars material per unit is a unit materials cost, comes straight out of means. Dollars material extension is count times unit cost. Hours per unit is hours of labor from means. Hours extension is the count times the unit labor. Dollars per hour local rate multipliers used on the final total and easily adjusted on the aggregate project. Line total is especially useful if you do a fine detail breakout. For instance, on this receptacle we were talking about, if you want to list the price of the receptacle device, the receptacle box, the cover plate, the conduit, the wire, and the termination labor. Nothing wrong with doing that. I mean, if this is the way you like to do it, if this is the way you're forced to do it, that's a good way to do it. But you should have a line total for the receptacles nonetheless. Just it helps on the reasonableness testing. A group total is very good. For instance, if you have a central computer room. Now, the central computer room may be an out-of-budget cost. It may not roll in to the capital construction cost because of the way the funding agency works, because of the rules regarding tax money. I mean, there can be a lot of reasons that you want to keep the cost for the central computer room separate from the rest of the construction budget. So you do the estimate exactly the same, but you have a total for the central computer room that can be included or excluded easily, and have somebody else look at it and say, hey, you know, does that look right? Would you be willing to install it for that price? So get another reasonableness test on it. Page total is an alternate check value. Some people that I respect very greatly are so careful in their page totals, and then the actual last page of their estimate is page 1 total, page 2 total, page 3 total, and the grand total. Notes, it's very, very valuable to record the assumptions built into the estimate. Now, at the beginning, someone might have been objecting to putting down the reference number from the means handbook. The reason I do that is every estimate I've ever done, I've had to go back and rethink items. And it's nice to be able to go back to the place you were looking at the first time. I won't say it's a shortcoming of means. It's a feature of means that they have the same materials listed in different sections. One section I really love is towards the end of the book. They've got feeders, complete feeders, the conduit, the conductors, the supports, and terminations. And they'll give you a cost per foot of a completed feeder. Well, that's a real slick way to do motor feeders. It might not be a nice way to do individual receptacles in a classroom. And again, when you get special wiring, obviously you have to do it yourself. But if it's 3 conductors and a ground, it seems like an aggregate's a nice way to do it. There are a range of electronic estimating tools available. Means has an electronic version, which includes all the cost tables, but aids you in constructing the detail estimate and estimate summary. Many firms have in-house standard spreadsheets, which may or may not include cost data, but do improve computational accuracy. Means contains a table of probable construction costs on a dollars per square foot basis. It's in section 17-100. A small part of the table is paraphrased here. Very hard to communicate this in the oral version of this, but I'll try to give you an idea of what's going on here. In the block called 17-100, square foot cost, SF is square foot, we've got a reference number, a detail reference number, some description, unit of measure, then units cost, and percent of the project total. Now, the unit costs are further broken down into a median, a first quartile, and a third quartile. What that means is that they give you a number you can use and run with, but they give you a range so you can look at, see if this is something that has a high amount of variability in it. Then you can start scratching your head. Are you in a high-cost area? Are you in a low-cost area? Or is it reasonable to just use the median value they give? First entry is 760 is the large number, 0010 is the detail number, school, junior high, and middle school. Square foot cost. Now this is, I believe it's electric. No. It's broken out here. The square foot cost for junior high and middle is $86.7 per square foot total. Then below that, it's broken out into masonry, $10.5 per square foot, equipment, $3.8 per square foot, plumbing, $5.1 per square foot, HVAC, $10.3 per square foot, electrical, $8.5 per square foot, total mechanical and electrical is $24.6. Now, why would you want to do that? Well, because it gives you a quick answer. If you know the square foot, you know a base number to start talking about for the cost of construction, for the electrical component of the cost of construction. Architect will probably tell you what his estimate is for the overall project. Again, you check it against this, see if we're talking about the same school. If his number's a lot higher, he knows something you don't. If his number's a lot lower, again, there's something going on here that needs exploring. Using this information, for a 28,700 square foot middle school, it would be $27,800 times $8.5 per square foot, or $236,300 for the electrical bid. To use this information correctly, it's highly recommended that you study the narrative material in the means estimating guide. If you have a new employee fresh out of college who is extremely enthusiastic and very computer literate, it is valuable to spend an afternoon just looking at the pictures and studying the fine print in means. There's a lot of field information you wouldn't pick up in college. A lot of good questions come from looking at those pictures. Optional narrative. When I issue a construction estimate, I always say, based on the 2007 Means Electrical Estimating Guide, the probable cost of construction for electrical will be $236,000 plus contingency. We never say construction estimate, because some people confuse engineers with tailpipe salesmen and consider an estimate to be a contract amount. I always call out the contingency as being excluded, because they always want to add it to the overall project, not to each component of the project. And again, the key words here are probable cost of construction. That is supposed to be less confusing than construction estimate. Pre-design, early context, and this begins with an optional narrative. Get permission from the architect or project manager before contacting authorities or utilities. The architect often has preferred contacts, persons he's worked with in the past, and he's got an intense interest in maintaining good relationships with these people for future projects. You must identify a person, phone number, fax number, hopefully an email address for a person at each utility involved. That's electric power, telephone, cable TV, data, satellite. If electrical design is doing in-classroom data, you need a computer support person to contact within the school system. Definitely, the school has ways they prefer to do it. They've had some bad experiences. They want to make sure they avoid them on this project. There is a person who has that responsibility in their organization. If you're doing the design for it, you've got to get to know that person. The utilities today are hiding from their customers. If you've ever tried their electronic receptionist, you know exactly what I mean. It will be a challenge to make contact with the right person at each utility, and at least one person will change jobs during the course of the project with no notice or arrangement to carry the project forward. Care and maintenance of your utility contact file is very important. You must have a street address for the construction. It's helpful to have a personal knowledge of the overhead utilities within several blocks. A Sunday afternoon ride carrying a digital camera can be very valuable. Sometimes a school staff person or the architect will tell you that a particular utility is not within the electrical design scope. Check this direction, confirm this direction back to the person in writing, copy your boss, and place a copy in your project file. And no one's trying to trick you. What's happening is early in the project, things look different than they do late in the project. And when it suddenly comes as a surprise, we forgot to do that, sometimes they start looking at the electrical engineer. It's nice to have something in your file that you anticipated this, and of course, you're willing to help out when needed. An electric power utility contact script might follow this form. Hello, this is Ingrid Wallace. I'm an electrical engineer with JBL Consulting Engineers. Are you the person I should be talking to about new service or a service upgrade for the William H. Taft High School at 12351 Highland Avenue? I am glad to share with you everything I know and keep you up to date, but may I first have your direct phone number, fax, and email? Right now, we are planning occupancy in August 2009, and we have a 480/277 volt 1200 amp switchboard and 255 ton electric chillers. And at this point, you can describe the project and answer specific questions that come up. It is almost essential to finish the conversation. What is the procedure for me to request the available short circuit current at that location? The utility will have very limited choices available for the school. Typically, secondary service must be provided. That means the utility owns the transformers and the revenue meter is between the transformer and the school. An alternate primary metering has the school owning the transformer. The meter would be on the high voltage side or on the low voltage side with credit for transformer losses. The only time you see new primary service installations are very large campus complexes, and when the utility gives the school a chance to buy a PCB contaminated transformer, typically for a dollar. Pre-design, responsibilities of the architect. The latest interpretation of the American Institute of Architects is that the project architect is responsible for coordinating all design disciplines and assuring that information flows freely among them. This is some change and has not been universally accepted in the architectural community. The architect is responsible for determining the controlling codes and providing occupancy and construction class information. These numbers are usually on a lead sheet in the plans or review set, but so very often not shared with the design disciplines. The architect invests considerable effort in planning circulation within the building. That is, how many people will be expected to walk each way at various times of the day in each corridor. The architect will assume magnetic door hold opens to maintain pedestrian traffic. But he may not tell you if you don't ask or if you don't notice them on a door schedule. Magnetic door hold opens must be released by the fire alarm system and require additional smoke detectors. If the architect is putting in fire shutters, they will require power and a fire alarm connection. Most architects have standard treatments for bathrooms, lobbies, and offices, usually involving cove lighting, downlight cans, and surface or recessed 2x4 fluorescence. A few minutes talking to the architect or one of his designers will give you a head start well in advance of release of the reflected ceiling diagrams. Be warned that some funding authorities are demanding detailed lighting drawings at the earliest stages of the project. The work in preparing the drawings is not great, but the architect may not be ready to commit, and it's awkward to change the basic scheme from one review drawing set to the next. for the state of Ohio and for the city of Detroit, Michigan. They're published design guides that are rigidly enforced, or the project may be stopped until the discrepancies are corrected. No such guidelines were found for the state of New York or for major municipalities. It's critical to check with the architect to see if special rules will be enforced on the current school design. Per the American Institute of Architects, the architect has final responsibility for coordination of designs. ASME A17.1 controls elevator hardware, and the New York Elevator Inspector approval is required to get an occupancy permit for the school. These are architect responsibilities, but often the electrical designer is better versed in the regulations and has inspection checklists from previous jobs. After work with an architect, it should involve a single meeting and review of elevator specifications and shop drawing submittals. Pre-design, use of sub-consultants. There are three good reasons to use sub-consultants. To get resources you do not have, to supplement your resources at an economic advantage, and to comply with regulatory requirements. Resources you do not have may refer to special tools, special skills, or just available hours. Many vendors will do free design if you specify their materials or use their proprietary specification, which effectively excludes alternates. Optional narrative. Your instructor has strong feelings on this topic, which may appear not to be shared widely in the consulting community. His interpretation of engineering ethics is that you shouldn't spend extra client money to increase your profit. The contrary argument is that there are very few superior products, and if you want the superior product, it is reasonable to let the rep for that product help write the spec and give you installation details. They're skilled designers who work very efficiently and cheap, meaning net project cost, not dollars per hour. We have a fellow we use that charges, I think it's $45 an hour, but his net cost to do a preliminary design is way below anything we could do in-house. So be careful when you talk about working efficiently and cheap. I'm big on lump sum projects. I don't believe in time and materials. Sometimes you have to turn in timesheets to satisfy the auditors and the accountants, but everybody knows it's a lump sum contract if you negotiate it that way. It would appear that everyone benefits when these skills can be incorporated into the project with proper supervision, coordination, and checking. Optional narrative. I have seen this work well. I have seen it work badly. It's not a benefit to rework all the subconsultant effort the night before submission. The key is the person working on your job. A subconsultant individual can be very reliable. A subconsultant firm may not be. An area to be discussed in more detail later is data wiring. Many funding agencies require that the design be performed by an RCDD. That's a Registered Communications Distribution Designer. Information from www.bicsi.org. This license is difficult to obtain, requires annual continuing education and retesting. Usually an RCDD is a full-time cabling salesman and or designer. Most electrical engineers cannot justify the time and cost in maintaining the license. This is an appropriate subconsultancy situation. Pre-design, time, date, and form of deliverables. At the kickoff meeting of the project and at every meeting during the project, it should be restated what form, what date, and what time the next project deliverables are due. It is unfortunate how many projects approach an intermediate review with no definition as to whether electronic drawing files are required, or electronic print files, that's PDF files, or paper full-size plots or paper half-size plots. Almost every job has games played on day and time of delivery. A good delivery target is end of business on Friday, which everyone interprets as start of business on Monday, giving them 16 easy hours of additional work and up to 60 hard hours of additional work. One lead designer recently stated in an email, "My set doesn't have to be done Wednesday. My QA guy is out of town until next Monday." From his viewpoint, this was a valid conclusion. However, the other designers needed his best, most complete work to coordinate their work. In the American Institute of Architects paradigm for the project, the three sections are schematic design, SD, detailed design, DD, and construction documents, CD. We have just discussed some of the aspects between negotiating for the design contract and the completion of schematic design. This concludes section one, and I hope you will join us for section two, which will address the question of power and details of electric power design.